Hello, this is Philip Cargom. Welcome to this recording of a conversation I had on a warm autumn day in October 2018 with the author and leadership coach, Nick Williams. The sound quality isn't great, I'm afraid, but I do hope you enjoy our discussion. I had asked Nick if we could meet up because I'd recently received an interesting email from Guy in Switzerland who wrote, "I'd love to hear something about connecting spirituality and our work lives. I know so many people who really want to combine their spiritual ideas and ideals with their job situation. But for all of them, including myself, it is really challenging because there seem to be only two options, both with serious drawbacks. Either you risk your reputation as a scientist or worker, making it difficult keeping your job or finding a new one. Or, if you choose to make your spirituality a top priority, working self-employed maybe as a healer, permaculture designer or celebrant, you can hardly make a living from this because you end up in this huge esoteric coaching and New Age jungle." Guy continues, "Are there any ideas for a better way to approach this? I think the question of how to integrate spirituality into a fulfilling life has become so important nowadays. I'd even say it's about to become something like a mega trend in the next few years. Over the last decade, the focus was on oneself, finding and walking an individual spiritual path. But now it has shifted towards the intersection with society and how to manage a sensible integration. The same pattern can be found elsewhere if we think of the millennials, Generation Y. They are no longer satisfied with just an ordinary career in a conventional job. They want to do something meaningful." So when I got Guy's email, I immediately thought of the one man who has made these sorts of subjects his life's work, really. And his name's Nick Williams. And so we've agreed to meet in London, and we're on the street where Pepys lived, just across from the Tower of London. So all the noise you can hear in the background is authentic City of London noise.
It's not, we're playing an LP in the background.
Yes, we're not, yes, exactly. Exactly. It's all designed to give an authentic feel for this interview. So, Nick, I'm so glad that you've come over to talk about this.
Oh, it's a joy. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's lovely. Yeah. Lovely to be with you.
Well, it's a pleasure, isn't it? Now, 20 years ago, you wrote a book, didn't you, that really addressed this question.
Well, I wrote The Work We Were Born to Do, 20 years ago. It came out in 1999. And I suppose the big kind of invitation in the book was, how can we make our work an expression of our spirituality, really? Because for most people, including myself, it had been a way of earning a living, it had been an economic and a financial activity. And I think the urge in me was, how can it also be a spiritual activity? How can my work be the best of me? And how can our work be the vehicle by which we express our love and our spirituality into this world and our gifts into this world and get well paid for it as
and
well.
And get well paid.
Potentially.
Exactly. Because so many people were, I remember, you know, when I was young, I started out working in a travel agency and feeling so trapped in what I conceived of as a sort of mundane work that had absolutely nothing to do with my spiritual interests. And then I suppose a turning point for me was when I realized that I could combine them. And it was, in a way, long before that idea of sort of spiritual travel, or sort of New Age travel sort of projects. But I planned some of those. And that's when I started to see how you can combine an apparently mundane work with something perhaps more along the lines of what you're interested in. But how did you start off in a mundane job, as it were?
Yes, yeah, basically, you know, I started off with Saturday jobs, then I did a degree in business studies, and then I had three different jobs in probably what you would call the corporate world, and then kind of gave that up to immerse myself in the spiritual and alternative worlds, and did that for about 20 years with Alternatives, and ended up co-leading and being kind of program director of Alternatives at St. James's. And really the last 10 years I've been kind of back in the mainline world. And I think probably one of the major things I'd like to start off saying is, I think, I'm not saying this is how it is, but this is just my way of looking at it. It's almost like we've got two job descriptions. We've got I suppose you'd call it our earthly job description, you know, what appears on our business card. Mm. But then I think what I've come to think about is our spiritual job description is probably very similar. We all share that job description, which is to bring a bit more love into the world, which is to bring a bit more inspiration, a bit more creativity, a bit more healing into the world. So I think I used to think there were some jobs or some work that was more intrinsically spiritual than others. But I've met some pretty unholy healers. I won't say where I live, but I live somewhere in London. I remember when I moved in there was a New Age shop there. It's not there anymore. And I went in there and I thought, you know, you just haven't got a good vibe. Mm. You know, you're a New Age shop, but you're not. Are intrinsically more spiritual, and I've met incredibly spiritual leaders, I've met spiritual toilet attendants, cleaners, I've met spiritual customer service reps, whatever you want to call them,
Let's just stop at that moment, because I think that idea is just fabulous. I remember Stephanie and I meeting a guy who was raking the leaves on a beach in Barbados, and he was the most spiritual guy ever. We ended up every morning we would go down to the beach and we would chat to him, and it would just be about everyday things, about the weather, about life in Barbados and all the rest of it. And we ended up, the last day of our holiday, hugging, each of us hugging him, and him saying, you know, God bless you. And, and it was just such a lovely... Yes, I think that idea of seeing that the spiritual, you know, our spiritual visiting card, as it were, business card, as you say, yes, we're all... It's about bringing more love and inspiration and joy into the world and creativity.
And I talk a lot about, you know, the whole idea of kind of fear and resistance, because I think we all have massive amounts of it. And I think, in a way, one form of resistance is saying, well, there is some, you know, perfect spiritual job for me to do, but I just haven't found it yet. Yes. And I'm a great believer that whatever you're doing, you can bring your spirituality to it. You know, whether you're working in a supermarket, whether you're a leader of a multinational, you can bring love, you can bring spirituality to that.
Yes.
Because in essence, if we're all spiritual beings, how could we not?
Yes.
So that's, for me, why it's also an inner journey. It's like, how can I find more of my own spirituality and bring it to whatever I'm doing? Whether for me that's as a writer, as a coach, as a speaker, as a kind of, you know, program creator. How do I bring my heart and my love and my spirituality to those things, rather than thinking, well, you know, if I find the right course, this will be a really spiritual course.
And maybe I should become a celebrant, a writer, or whatever.
Yeah.
But how would you address somebody who said, well, that's all very well, but I'm trapped in an office 9 to 5 as doing IT or accountancy. How can I infuse that with my... How can I be spiritual with it?
Well, I think there's two things. Either you make a choice to be more loving right where you are, or you do make a choice and say, I don't want to be here. I want to be somewhere else where I can be more spiritual or more loving or more inspired or creative. But I have met many people, and I've probably been one of them at times, that just hops around, you know, trying to find the right thing, rather than going, when am I going to go deeper where I am?
Mm.
So it can be an avoidance, it can be... a way of kind of not committing to things. But also, I think, you know, this is just my belief, but, you know, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles. So, you know, in A Course in Miracles, it talks about the Holy Spirit always talking to us. So whatever you might believe in, spirit, higher power, higher self, I think that's always nudging us. So I think if we're really honest with ourselves, we can also be clear on, you know, when do we commit to where we are, and when is it time to graduate and do something else? And that's part of the coaching I do with people. It's like, you know, is it time to go deeper where you are, or is it time to graduate and do something else? Is there another project calling?
That's a really interesting idea. So say if I'm imagining I'm stuck in a job that I'm not enjoying, I have all these spiritual interests and I want to express them in the world. So what you're suggesting to me is just stop for a moment and ask yourself, do you need to actually go deep inside to stay where you are, to somehow almost like extract the meaning and the depth in what's happening right now for you? Or perhaps you've done that already and it really is time to move on, and the spirit, as it were, is prompting you, pushing you to move on. And then it's perhaps not about finding the ideal, the perfect thing, but just what is that next step for you? You know, even if that happens to be another mundane job, but where you can express your love or your creativity a bit more openly and freely.
I remember listening to Marianne Williamson, who I hosted her a number of times through Alternatives, and I remember one of the things she said, which really struck a chord with me, and I'm, you know, as you're speaking, it's just reminded me. She said, you know, so many of us say, pray to God for a brilliant career. Mm. And she said, there is an even more powerful prayer, and I, you know, I just remembered it. And she said, you know, pray to be delivered to your own brilliance.
Delivered to your own brilliance.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the bit. It's like, pray to be delivered to your brilliance and bring that to whatever you're doing. Mm. And yes, you could be in a potentially kind of sterile, abusive, bullying environment. Mm. But you could be the one who leads the way in making it a bit kinder. Mm. You know, that's why I'm today much more fascinated by the idea of leadership. It's very easy to feel the victim. Mm. You know, and so many people today, you know, inhabit that place of being the victim and compete for the victim position. And I've been there myself. I know what that's like. It's a horrible place to be. And it can be very easy for, I think, spiritual people to end up feeling victimized, going, well, I've got all these wonderful gifts that nobody seems to want, mm. you know, and nobody seems to appreciate. But I love that idea of pray to be delivered to your own brilliance, to bring it to your existing career or your existing business or your existing leadership, whatever it is that you're up to.
Exactly. One of the things I think that happens when you take the spiritual path is you become more sensitive, if you like. You're tuning in to all these positive ideas, but also ideas of the other world, of subtle energies. And whilst there's great value in it, it can sometimes make you feel less able to cope with the stresses of everyday life, because there's a certain sort of toughness you need in dealing with the world, if we can put it like that, that seems to be at odds with, or can seem to be at odds with, the sensitivity that you develop spiritually. But I think, I mean, my sense of the answer to that is to yes, be sensitive, but also to know when not to be sensitive. I mean, when I come here to the middle of London with all the hustle and bustle, I'm not being sensitive, you know. I'm just being sort of grounded in myself and just functioning in the world. I think it's a question of sort of knowing which level you're operating on, and then
You know, I've done a lot of men's work over the last 3 decades, and I think one of the things that I've really appreciated is learning about the kind of archetypal energies as well. You know, there's time to be in your lover, you know, very sensitive. There's time to be in your magician and transformative. There's time to be in your sovereign, you know, be a blessing person. There's also time to be in your warrior energy. And a lot of, you know, a lot in business and in leadership is about warrior energy, you know, setting boundaries, saying, we need to get on with this. You know, it's not just, and I don't mean this in a critical way, but it's not just about thinking about your feelings. You know, sometimes things just need to get done.
Yes.
And I'm not saying feelings aren't important, and there are times when we just need to get on and do stuff. You
know, yes.
I'm somebody who used to get very taken out by his own feelings. If I felt like doing something, I'd do it. If I didn't feel like doing it, I wouldn't do it. And I think I've needed to learn to become much more, I feel like, objective and go, I need to do this regardless of how I feel. Mm. I can attend to my own feelings. That's not to ignore my feelings.
Yes.
But sometimes I just simply need to act.
Yes.
I need to do things. And for me, that's been about also, you know, the language I would use today is about developing a discipline and a devotion that I was lacking earlier in my life. You know, so I go out and write pretty much every morning for an hour and a half, two hours.
You write for an hour and a half? Yeah.
You know, I used to think, well, if I feel like it, I'll go out and write. Mm-hmm. And I realised, you know, my feelings come and go. You know, everybody's feelings come and go.
Yeah.
But by learning to write, and I've probably done it every day now for the last 10 years, I've developed that discipline and that devotion. And I remember reading something. Somebody apparently asked Luciano Pavarotti, you know, the opera singer. They said, "How are you so disciplined that you know, practice every day like you do?" And his answer was very interesting. He said, "It's not discipline; it's devotion." And to me, you know, I don't know if he said this, but this is my version of what he might have said: is, you know, once you've discovered what you love, you need to devote yourself to it. Mm. And that's what I do every morning. I devote myself to expressing
myself. And then that becomes a discipline.
Yeah, but it doesn't feel like
it. Doesn't feel like it.
And I think, you know, going back to what you were raising earlier, something I would also say is I think we've all got reasons not to give ourselves. Mm. So, you know, we can look at environments around us and go, oh, this isn't a safe place to give of the best of me. Mm. But actually, it might be the very place where the best of you is needed. Mm. So I think when we're devoted to something, we say, you know, depending, irrespective of how I feel, I'm going to devote myself to doing this. Mm. It's like being in a long-term relationship. There are times you think, what the heck am I doing in this relationship?
Yeah.
Most of us feel like that about anything that we're in relationship with for a long time. You know, whether it's our own spiritual path, whether it's our partner, whether it's our work, there are times we're going, I think I'm out of here, I've had enough, you know. But as we plough through that, then we come to a new chapter, I believe. You know,
it's that old I Ching admonition, isn't it? Perseverance furthers.
Yeah, and there's time to move on.
Yeah,
there is time. I'm not saying you have to stick with something that really isn't right for you, but I think sometimes, you know, just in the last couple of years, I've taken up lawn bowls, you know, as I'm getting older, and I'm loving it.
Yeah.
And there are times when I'm really crap at it. And I remember reading a book by Seth Godin years ago called The Dip, and it was about how, you know, a lot of people just ditch when things get tough.
Mm.
You know, they don't go through that dip. Yes. And I realise, you know, we all go through dips. We all go through times when we think, I can't do this.
Mm.
You know, in the hero's journey, it's the kind of all hope is lost kind of moment. You think, I was stupid ever to think I could do this.
Mm.
We all have them. But once we realise we have them, we can endure them and come out the other side of it.
Right, I just realised that I was holding my iPhone upside down. So if the sound is much better now, folks, it's because I've turned the phone round the other way. I do apologise. Right, Nick, back to this idea of the dip. It's rather like, it's a fascinating idea, because you talk about dip. If you think in terms of a long-term relationship, you know, we all go through these dips, these troughs, where you think, well, you know, why am I in this relationship? How's it going? And all right, why, you know. And it's a question of deciding, do I go through the trough and then come back up again, or am I actually supposed to leave this relationship? And of course, every case is going to be different. And I suppose the same thing applies with a job, really. If you're feeling stuck in a job and you're saying, I'm not expressing my spiritual nature in this job, it's a question of saying, well, is this something you've got to work through? You know, work through this feeling of stuckness. And maybe you can come out the other side of it, stay in the job, but somehow find ways to express your love and your creativity in it. Or is this time to move on?
So I talk a lot about, you know, I mentioned it earlier about, you know, believing there is a, I don't know what you would call it, I tend to call it the voice for inspiration.
Yeah.
So to me, you know, I am a lot of the time guided by a voice of inspiration that helps me understand what's true. You know, so would it be true to stay or would it be true to leave?
That's really interesting. So how do you in practice do that? Yeah. Is it through meditation? Do you have a technique for tuning into that?
Yeah, I suppose yes, you know, and I just ask the question, you know, what's the truth here? You know, and I think what I've realized increasingly over the years is, you know, that Buddhist idea is wherever you go, you take yourself with you.
Yeah.
So I've spent a lot of time trying to put myself in different places to escape myself.
But actually coming back to where you are.
Yeah. So I'm not saying don't change, because, you know, I could take that and say, well, should I have stayed in my corporate job?
Yeah.
You know, could I have done better by staying where I was? I don't know, but I don't think so. I think I needed to leave and start my own business and be independent and freelance over the last 3 decades. It feels really right for me to have done that. So there are times to change. There are times to change your circumstances. And there are times just to go deeper. But even though I changed my circumstances, it was just the beginning of a whole new evolution of, like, becoming entrepreneurial and understanding how to run my own business, which I'd never done before. And how do I, you know, like I said earlier, how do I get delivered to my own brilliance? And for me, that's an ongoing journey of going deeper and deeper into myself, if you like, and finding more and more of myself to bring.
And I suppose as well, identifying your values, you know, this idea of what's really important to me.
Mm.
And somehow I think that can help as well,
mm.
you know. And you were talking earlier, before we started recording this, you were talking about how you found that you had ended up doing one thing when in fact you realised at some point that what you really enjoyed was doing something slightly different. And, you know, the leadership coaching.
Mm.
And you just realised that you just had to shift your focus to actually what you really preferred doing.
Yeah, and do a lot of inner work.
Mm.
I don't know. Do you know anything about the Enneagram?
The Enneagram, yeah.
You know, in the Enneagram, I'm a 4. I don't know
if you know much about that, but you know, for people that don't know anything about it, you know, what I love about the Enneagram is it tells us what us at our best can look like and us at our most unhealthy can look like.
And what I'll do is with this interview, I'll put up a link to an Enneagram test that you can do online, so people can find that out.
So a friend of mine, you know, did a test for my 50th, so a decade ago, and you know, I came out as a 4 on the Enneagram, the individualist. So it helped me see that at my best, I am creative, I'm inspired, I'm renewing, I take everything that happens to me and turn it into a gift for everybody else, which rings really true.
Hmm.
But I know that at my worst, I can be depressed, I can be suicidal, I can feel like I have no worth and no value whatsoever.
Hmm.
So for me to grow into working at a leadership level, I had to do a lot of my own inner work about my own sense of insignificance.
Mm.
You know, it's very easy for me to have that inner critic in my head that says, who the heck wants to listen to you?
Mm.
You know, these people in leadership, you know,
the big wigs, they know
so. Yeah, they're the grown-ups. I'm just the little kid who, you know, can get upset easily.
Yeah.
So I've had to do a lot of growth to put myself in that situation. And the way that I've described it now is, you know, there's been a place I've visited over the years, but I didn't feel like I belonged there. And now I feel like, yeah, this is where I belong at this point in my life. But it's taken me to the age of 60 to get here and feel like I belong here. And that's a lot about my own worth. So, you know, taking this as a wider conversation for people listening, it's like, you know, what's right for us at one point, we keep graduating, I think.
It'll change with your life stage.
To get better and better, You know, but for me, you know, I suppose as a 4 as well on the Enneagram, you know, my life is a continual blossoming, but then there's often a winter time before the springtime.
Yes.
Something has to die before something else can be born.
Yes.
An old self-concept, an old sense of myself has to dissolve away so that something new can emerge.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, perhaps, another way of sort of reframing how we're looking at this is in terms of, you know, you say how you've come to a way of working now that, you know, it took you until you were 60 to sort of feel you were absolutely in the right position or doing the work, you know, although all the work you were doing before but there was probably more of a sense of a struggle or like you were trying to get somewhere.
Yes, I feel like for the last 30 years now, I have been doing what I was born to do. You
know, yeah.
A bit of a hypocrite having written a book called What We Were Born to Do. I've only just discovered it myself, actually, in the age of 60. But I think what I've realised is that what we are born to do has many chapters to it.
Yeah. If we see it as a journey, because I think what happens is when you're young, you want to arrive at the destination. It's as if, say, the myth is something like this. There is a work I'm born to do.
Mm.
You know, and I see, you know, perhaps a friend who's a doctor, and you think, oh wow, you know, he's only 25 and he's already sort of doing this work he's born to do. He's healing people and helping people. And I say, how come I can't get there? You know, but in fact, what's happening is, you know, he as well, that doctor will also be going on a journey that he may be in general practice, but in the end, by the time he's 50, he's homed in on pediatrics or something, and that's really where he feels he's got to make his contribution. And that feeling of sort of being totally settled and totally doing what you want, maybe it doesn't come until later, except to a few rare souls. And you almost see the reverse situation. I mean, I've always thought it'd be a fascinating study, psychological study, of studying young people who peak early. You know, those sad tales of people who become, you know, stars or whatever when they're young. And then that phase is over, and then the rest, what happens to the rest of their lives?
Yeah, but they spend the rest of their lives.
Very tragic, often. Yeah.
So I think there's two things that you raised there, that especially around work, I think, are especially important. Number one is, you know, I talked about it in the work we're born to do, but I see it around the world. You know, I've given talks in 17 different countries around the world, and whenever I talk about this, everybody puts their hand up. And it's the idea that most of us are brought up to believe, to some extent, that we shouldn't enjoy what we do. You know, I came to call it the Protestant work ethic and traced it back to, you know, whatever, the 16th century, and the idea, you know, nasty idea in a way. I think it's an ego idea. I don't think it's a spiritual idea that God hates us. And one of the ways that we can pay a penance is by doing work and suffering. So I think that still carries on to today, that a lot of us are kind of doing work we don't enjoy as a form of suffering. That maybe one day it's going to buy us something. But I think what I've also realised that, you know, I was driven by that myself. And I think I've given up more of the suffering. So it's saying it's okay to enjoy what I do and it's okay to get paid for what I do. Because I think a lot of people say, well, I can do what I love, I can do what I want to do, but as long as I don't get too good at it and I don't succeed at it too much,
yes,
that's too much.
Can't make money out of it either. Yeah. So that you split your life into the unpleasant activity that you make money out of.
Sure. Yeah.
As it were. It's very odd when you analyse it in this way, but it's sort of true, isn't it?
No.
Or the enjoyable things, where usually you'll probably spend money going to the cinema, going out for meals, and so on.
So, I've seen that in myself, and I've seen it in other people. It's like, yes, you know, excuse my language, you know, you always edit this out if it's no good, but I do shit work and I get money as a compensation for it.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I spend all my money, you know, compensating myself for what I hate doing. Or then I go and do something I love, but I shouldn't expect to get paid very much for it. And if I do, I feel guilty, so I stop myself doing too well at it. So I've certainly gone those two extremes of the pendulum, and I've seen other people do that too. It's like, you know, they start their own business, but they don't do very well, and they have to go back to a job and earn money to pay off their debts, and then they pay off their debts, get a bit of money in the bank, and they go and do something they love, but they then don't, you know, it's the extremes. And the breakthrough for me, actually, one of the things that helped me break through, you know, it's sad he died a while ago, but I heard an interview with Leonard Cohen.
Mm.
And he just had a very, very simple thing, because somebody asked him the question in this interview. They said to him, did you ever have a kind of, you know, an agenda or a manifesto for being an artist in the 1960s? He said, no, there's only one thing that I wanted. He said, I didn't want to work for pay, but I did want to be paid for my work. And I just thought, what a subtle but powerful...
I didn't want to work for pay, but I did want to be paid...
For my work.
Yeah, that's
And I think that's such an interesting distinction, because I think a lot of people go, well, I work for pay.
Mm.
But what he was saying is, I work for love, really. And well, that would be my interpretation. Yeah. And I feel like that. I work for love. Mm. I'm on team love.
Yes.
And I'm willing to be paid to be on team love.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people think, well, if I'm on team love, I shouldn't expect to get paid for it. This is just my spiritual karma, my dharma, to be working for love.
Yeah.
I don't expect to get paid for it. And I think that's something I wave a flag for is, you know, do what you love, do what you're on earth to do, and be very well paid for it if you want to. But don't do it to get well paid, but be willing to be well paid. Do it because you love it.
Do it because you love it. And what would you say to... one of the things that Guy was asking, really, was it's as if... maybe this isn't true, but what I hear when I read his email is there are all these... There's basically two kinds of jobs. There's ordinary jobs, mundane jobs, if you like, in the business world, in the world of commerce and so on. And then there are the cool spiritual jobs.
Hmm.
There's, you know, being a healer, writing books, doing workshops. And that's a jungle. He talked about the sort of New Age jungle. Hmm. If you give up your straight, ordinary, dull commercial job and try to make money out of the other lot, you'll enter this jungle. Mm. And lots of people don't succeed in that.
Mm.
Do you think that's the wrong way to look at the job?
Well, there's probably some truth to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, yes. Well, everywhere's a jungle.
Yeah.
And I think the New Age of spiritual world can just be much of a jungle as well. You know, I've spent a lot of time in both areas. Mm. And to some extent, I prefer the kind of commercial world, because I think, you know, if people are greedy there, at least they're open about being greedy. Whereas I think in the New Age, I've often found people that are all love and light, but they haven't looked at their own shadow.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I wonder...
Both sides can be a jungle.
Yes. And both sides have their shadow sides, and you know, I wonder. I'm just thinking straight off the top of my head now, but I'm thinking about, you know, if you really feel called to, say, be a celebrant and to learn how to lead funerals or weddings, or you feel called to, you know, be a healer or do healing or whatever that. What if you just start to integrate that into your life? You know, for instance, you know, we run a celebrancy course, an online course, and River in Brighton, River Jones, who teaches it, is fantastic. And she first did a training in it, and then she started to do mainly funerals. Now she does lots of weddings as well. And to begin with, she had her other job working at Sussex University, and every so often she'd be asked to do a funeral and would make a little bit of money from that. Until now, she's a full-time celebrant. It may have worked out differently. She may never have got enough
jobs as a celebrant. But it worked out because she loved it and because she was good at it. Now she's doing that, and now she also runs our celebrancy training course. So I wonder if that would be a sort of an answer for Guy, would be to say, well, look, if there is a particular calling you feel drawn to, why not just try to integrate that?
Yeah,
and to do, you know, both.
A word I use a lot, or a phrase I use a lot, is about the difference between showing off and showing up. And I think that, you know, what I grew up in a kind of Methodist household. My dad was a lay preacher, and I was always told as a child not to show off. So it took me a very, very long time to understand that there was a difference between showing off and showing up. And most of us have a, you know, a judgment on people that show off, or a dislike of people that show off. So we confuse that and say, well, you know, I shouldn't have to market myself. Mm. I shouldn't have to create a brand around what I do or anything like that.
Mm.
And I think, actually, you do.
Mm.
But it doesn't have to be obnoxious.
Mm.
It can. I thought about this a few years ago. You know, I ran a, I think it was back in 2012, I ran a kind of online teleseminar series about personal branding. And part of me approached it with a bit of trepidation, going, I'm not sure how much I believe in this thing that I'm co-leading a teleseminar series on. But it was quite a transformational process for me. And the piece I came to with it was, yes, a brand can be a purely commercial invention. Mm. So many are. And we love our brand, you know.
Mm.
I'm not against them. You know, I love my Apple iPhone. I love my, you know, whatever. And that's a commercial invention, but it feels congruent, you know, at least some of them do. But the other thing that, but the piece I came to was that a brand can also be the full expression of your spirituality.
Mm.
It can be the full expression of your leadership. It can be the full expression of your creativity. So, you know, again, I think what happens is that, you know, the commercial world can judge the spiritual world,
mm.
but I think the spiritual world can be just as full of judgments about the commercial world.
Mm.
I think where I'm getting to is, like, don't judge any of it particularly. Be discerning by all means.
Mm.
But I like the idea of having branding around what you were born to do, what you're on the earth to do.
Mm.
And to be grown up and create a grown-up brand, like, you know, your colleague that runs the program. She's probably done that. She said, this is who I am, this is what I do, this is how I can help and serve who might like to hire me.
Mm.
You know, she's not sitting at home waiting for the phone to ring. She's probably getting herself out there, being
the website, being as known
up.
As a celebrant.
Yeah.
And that distinction between
show up and not be obnoxious.
There's also a cultural difference there. Mm. I mean, I really like that, because showing up is like being fully present to who you are,
yeah.
and saying, here I am in the world, and this is what I offer, as it were. Whereas showing off is, I remember you also make a distinction between grandeur and grandiosity.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I was just thinking that when you were speaking.
So this is me in my grandeur, as it were,
yeah.
not in my grandiosity. And that's a really good...
Shall I just explain where that
comes
from?
Yes,
do. For one second. Yeah, as I said, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles, and there's just probably a page or two in the book about this. And it says, you know, grandiosity is of our ego.
Mm.
And grandiosity is either how we inflate ourselves by our ego. So I'm the best healer, I'm the best coach, I'm much better than everybody else, whatever, whatever.
Mm.
You know, and we find that obnoxious, rightly. But also grandiosity can be how we shrink ourselves down. We go, nobody wants me, you know, nobody wants my gifts. You know, that is still an act of grandiosity. Because what the Course says is, you know, you were created with a grandeur of spirit in you.
Mm.
And that ties back to that idea of, like, how do we get asked to be delivered to our brilliance.
Mm.
Our brilliance is our grandeur.
Mm.
It's how we were created.
Mm.
You know, whether we believe in a God or a higher power or a universe, to me it doesn't matter what language we use, but we were created with a grandeur of spirit in us. And the more we're willing to show up with that grandeur of spirit, I think the more we'll get hired, the more people will like us, the more they'll be drawn to us.
There's also a cultural difference, isn't there? I mean, in the States, for instance, people feel much freer to, from a British perspective, European perhaps, we can often perceive initiatives in coming out of the United States as showing off, as being, you know, and whereas. And I think at one level these are just cultural differences, but it's important to take that into account, I think. And perhaps using these distinctions is a way to sort it out. I think because we have a natural, here in sort of Britain, we have a natural tendency to slightly cringe when we get, hey, I'm the greatest, you know, person in the world kind of thing. That we go in the completely opposite extreme.
Yeah, which is, you know, we become grandiose the other way.
The other way, by being, because self-deprecation is a very English trait, isn't it? That you're attractive if you're self-deprecating. Yeah. And somehow we've got to get over that, I think.
Yeah, but it's taken me to this age, in a way, to get comfortable in going, you know what, I really am good at some things.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not showing off, it's just a fact.
Yeah.
And to me, grandeur is a fact.
Yeah.
It's not... And I think another distinction I'd like to bring in here is just about competition, because, you know, we're, in a way, we only go into grandiosity because we feel we need to compete. Whereas when we show up in what, you know, the language I'm using here is our grandeur, I think spiritually there's no competition to be us.
Mm.
I think if we all showed up in our grandeur, we'd all find our natural place.
And that's where I remember you talking a while back about... teamwork and sort of working with people. I think it was you were talking about how at some point you realised that you could team up with people instead of having to, you know, do an event yourself. You could team, and I remember realising that way back as well, that actually why not just hook up with somebody else and do something together? It's more fun, and you're not in competition.
But I think it's about, you know, I would call it kind of spiritual maturity in a way, or an emotional maturity, which is, you know, to not see people as your competition.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, I never read his book, but you probably heard of Robert Bly, the poet.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I think his follow-up to his book, Iron John, which was a bestseller, was a book called The Sibling Society.
Right, yeah.
And I think most of us have been brought up in that whole idea of, like, we're in competition with each other.
Mm.
And you're right, you know, it's not a business I run anymore, but my brand for about 10, 12 years was something called Inspired Entrepreneur.
Hmm.
You know, and I sat down with my business partner at the time and we had this conversation, which is, well, you know, I've written a book called The Work We Were Born to Do. Either anybody else that writes about life purpose is a competitor.
Yes.
Or we could create a platform and invite everybody that talks about this subject to come and talk on our platform.
Yes.
It just seemed to make so much more sense to not see other authors and other speakers as competition, but to see them as we're all on the same team.
Yeah.
So let's create a platform and pull everybody onto that platform and welcome them to talk about the bigger subject, if you like. But I think that's the shift I had to go through, is I stand for a bigger idea, not just my own agenda.
Yes, yes. It's not about your own personal ambition and
well,
wanting to get... Not only. Yes, I mean, there is your person.
I'm not denying that I have that. I like winning for myself. I don't mean winning against anybody else, but I like my life blossoming into the best it can be.
Mm.
But I do that by collaborating with other people, not by trying to undermine them or defeat them.
Defeat them and get on your own to scramble to the top of the mountain.
Let's all get to the top of the mountain together.
Together, exactly. I remember once getting a sort of self-development catalogue from the States, and there was this ridiculous photograph of a guy in a suit with a briefcase standing on a pinnacle of a mountain.
Yeah.
And it was like, that's it, he's made it. But you know,
where's everyone else?
Where's everybody else? How are you going to get down? You know, have you got
any sandwiches? It's a bit lonely up there.
It's a bit lonely. And have you got any sandwiches in the briefcase? You know, because you know, you're on your own.
Yeah.
So yes, yeah, absolutely. And so perhaps that's another an idea I had about, you know, Guy's question again about perhaps if we don't think in terms of just ourselves. I wonder if that helps. In other words, instead of saying, how am I going to be doing this? How am I going to make my life and my values and my work more spiritual? And seeing it as just you and your career and what you do. How about sort of just slightly taking this different perspective as you're part of a team, you know?
And you know, I've always loved, as I'm sure you have too, just the idea of being in service.
Yeah.
But again, I think what we often think of is to be in service means to be in sacrifice. Because we think we have to put other people before ourselves. And there's a lot of, you know, Christian thinking that says that. You know, even, you know, I remember talking to somebody who'd been in the army, and he had said, oh, you know, as a leader in the army, we're always taught to put other people first.
Yeah.
But I'm also about serving, but self-inclusion.
Mm.
We're either a martyr or we're selfish.
Yes.
In some ways of thinking, you know, either we martyr ourselves and we put everybody else first,
or we're selfish because
we're putting ourselves first. But what about us all being equals and including ourselves in the goodness?
Yes. and seeing the team when you're on Team Love, as you put it, you know, you're an equal member of the team. We're all in this together.
Yeah, it's spiritually there's no competition.
Yeah,
we're all here for a unique purpose. You know, if you believe in a universe or a God, God created us to do something here.
Yeah, yeah.
So why would we, you know, I don't think God's gone right. You know, you're here to compete with all these other people that are running businesses. Or you're here to compete with all the other healers to be the best. I don't think that's what the universe is asking us to do.
No, no.
Boy, do we need healing more than ever on the planet. You know, everybody who's got healing, show up with your healing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I also think we, you know, we've been created with particular gifts to help particular people. You know, and I'm sure you feel like this too. You know, I feel like I've spent 30 years developing those gifts so that I can now offer them to a new group of people, you know, people in leadership. And if one person in leadership shifts, that can affect the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. But it's taken me, you know, 30 years to get confident enough to be here. Can I just add one thing?
Sure.
When you're asking earlier, and I was talking about suffering. But I think also when we're younger, you know, it certainly was for me, and I think it often is, you know, we have probably no idea how much pain we're in. Yeah. So, you know, I certainly spent the first 10 years of my career trying to succeed my way away from how terrible I felt about myself.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't really until my early 30s I kind of started taking the lid off and going, I've been trying to compensate for how crap I really feel about myself.
And that's a really interesting point, because there's a way in which, I suppose, the idea of the ideal job, the job where you're completely in alignment with your spiritual ideals and you're doing something of great value to the world and so on, is also maybe it's a way that we avoid, I mean, just what you've just said there, a way of, by projecting into the future, you know, this idea that there's somewhere, I haven't quite got it yet, you know, there seem to be too many obstacles in the way. If only I could be a full-time healer or a full-time celebrant or whatever, then somehow everything else would sort itself out. I'd be fulfilling my dream and I would... Maybe that's not quite the most helpful way to look at it, you know. Because, as you say, I mean, particularly when you're younger, you know, Guy was talking about millennials again in there, so we're talking about young people. Is this whole journey, and I know, you know, you could say, you know, us old codgers sitting here saying, oh, you've got to work through this. But there is something, isn't there, about how we work, you know, it's about getting to know ourselves, becoming aware of the, you know, the alchemical work of dealing with our weaknesses and our doubts and gradually refining it. And sometimes the very challenges of being stuck in relationships, stuck in jobs, stuck in various ways financially, are actually all somehow, if we can only kind of work with them consciously, they become part of the alchemical process.
Well, they have the potential to
Have the potential to be.
When we have the willingness, I think, to be transformed. You know, you used that example of a doctor earlier. You know, you could look at a doctor and go, well, I'll be a doctor then.
Yeah.
Because if I do something good for humanity, then I won't feel so bad about myself.
Yes.
But that, you know, part of it is a compensation.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things I've been working through for a while, is, you know, not doing things as a compensation, but doing them out of true inspiration and doing them out of true love. I'm really inspired to do this, rather than, well, if I do this, then I won't feel so crap about myself. And I think for some people, if I'm honest, you know, my experience, it certainly was for me, if I'm a spiritual person, then I'll feel better about myself.
That's tricky.
I tried it and it didn't work. You know, I'd like the idea today that, you know, just being me. And I think being me means being spiritual, so, but it also means being secular and profane and all the other things at times. You know.
That's lovely, because that brings us to a beautiful sort of point, which is, you know, you could say the answer to this question. How about the answer to this question being, it's about being me. It's like, how, so the question then becomes, how can I just be fully myself? It's the old mystic quest of, you know, know thyself. So if we can apply, you know, our spiritual work, our psychological work, our relationship work, everything to working with the self, and then the job will sort itself out. You know, something around that.
Sure.
You know, which, so And that also brings up the idea of, rather than trying to work on the perfect job, which is over there, if you're working on me here, the self, not just the ego, as it were, but the self, the deep self, which is why, for me, the spiritual quest is sort of central to my life, because it's that work of self-knowledge that is the sort of gateway to everything else. Because if you can work in that way, then your relationships improve, your work life improves, and so on.
What came to mind, and there's a couple of albums that Bruce Springsteen did in the 90s that are not so well known, but there was a great song, I think it's called Better Days, and he said, one of the lines was, "It's a sad man, my friend, who's living in his own skin and can't stand the company." And it's like, whoa, so for all his success, he wasn't happy.
The
language I use these days is, I think I was very much, for the first maybe 10 years of my kind of spiritual path, on what I would call a path of self-improvement, which in a way was trying to create a better ego. I was trying to create a better version of myself because I didn't like the version of myself that I was. And it wasn't until I came across really A Course in Miracles, I don't think about 20 odd years ago, that I shifted into what I would now call a path of self-acceptance. What if I could love all of me? What if I could love my brilliance, my creativity, my leadership? What if I could love my sensitivity, my anger, my hurt, my despair? What if I can just love and accept all of them?
Love
and
all
meet
of
them
it.
All
yeah.
with compassion. And I totally agree with you. I think it's about who are we bringing to whatever we're doing that makes a difference.
So we shift our focus.
Your guy in Barbados, he was just bringing himself to sweeping leaves off the beach.
Yeah.
And it was inspiring to you.
Yeah.
And so, my next book I'm writing at the moment is called, I think the title is going to be Inspired, Be Inspiring, Be Yourself. Because I think it's very hard to be inspired or inspiring if we're trying to be somebody else.
Be somebody else. So be fully yourself and then be inspiring. Yeah.
I went to a day, Jack Cornfield was actually the Buddhist teacher. I went to a day with him a few months ago, and my big takeaway from it is he said, in Buddhism we just say, meet everything with compassion. Meet your pain with compassion, meet your suffering with compassion, meet your brilliance with compassion. And I think that's kind of where I've got to, isn't it? How much compassion can I show to all aspects of myself?
Which is why something like the loving kindness meditation is such a lovely one to do as a practice. Yeah.
So I'm agreeing with you and saying I think that's as important, if not more important, than finding what we were born to do. It's more about, in a way, who were we born to be? Can we
being,
love who we were born
being,
to be?
Being before doing, as it were. Yes. Yes, because the job is very much doing.
Yeah.
What job do you do? Yes, and it's. But let's shift the focus maybe to being first.
Who are you being and what you're doing?
Yes.
And I've met the most wonderful, loving, kind people in all areas of life. And I've met crap people in all areas of life.
Yeah.
And, I think you've had a listen to the programme. My friend who's the producer of Downton Abbey, who started off being a coaching client, she's become a friend, and she's the leader of one of the most successful kind of TV projects ever. But she says very openly in the conversation we had and recorded and that I've shared, she said, I look for the divine spark in people. I try and create an atmosphere of love where people feel safe to give their best. And I think we just need more leaders like that. She's a TV producer, and yet she's talking in the deepest spiritual language. And she has to deal with budgets and all that world and big egos. But somehow she tries to meet all that with compassion.
Yeah, isn't that fantastic?
So that's what inspires me. It's not about living in an alternative world. It's about living in the mainline world, but bringing our love and our spirituality to it as much as we can.
So it's not so much a question, as in Guy was saying, how do I step into that alternative world and not get caught in that jungle? That's kind of, maybe let's not look at it in that way. It's all about how can I just be in the world from that compassionate place.
But again, when I heard one of the expressions I heard Marianne Williamson use was, she said it's about building our spiritual musculature. And I think, like you were talking about, embracing our weaknesses and our flaws or where we feel flawed. And I think that's part of the journey. It's like, can we love those parts of us that we think are flawed? Can we, I think many of us have occasional glimpses of our own brilliance. But I think part of the journey is how can we live more from that place of brilliance in us? And at the same time go, you know, I can stand up and give a talk and be wonderful, and then I can get angry with the waiter for not bringing me the right milk with my tea, you know. It's all of me. You know, I can inspire people and I can be an arsehole the next minute with my language, you know. It's somehow that's the territory of being human. You know, and I talked to Liz, you know, that the Downton producer, and she did get kind of parachuted in to do another producing job, and it turned out to be a disaster.
Didn't work, yeah.
Because she violated some of her own values. You know, one thing she said is, you know, I picked my own team.
Yeah.
And she was parachuted in to work with another team, and it didn't work.
It didn't work, yeah.
So, you know, it brought out the worst in her in some respects. You know?
Yes.
Even though she can do a brilliant job.
It's really accepting the fact that one's not always going to get it right, and it's not always going to be perfect. And so you did an interview with there's a book and a recordings that you've done that people can find that on the website if you're interested. I love Downton Abbey as a series. I don't normally watch series at all. It's not my thing, you know, period dramas and all the rest of it, but for some reason Downton Abbey just gets me, and I just love it. There's a feeling of warmth that I get from it that is really special. So it was great to, when I read this material, I was really intrigued by that. So that's on your website, and then your book's coming out in March.
Well, book 16 is coming
book
out.
Book 16
in, about
in March, yeah, because Nick's
the rest
15.
Are already available.
The rest are already available. So if people go on your website, they can see the work that I was born to do, that you were born to do, is available. That's
ones,
on.
Yeah, and then there's. I had a bit of a brand running for a while, so there's the business you were born to create, the book you were born to write. Because I do feel there is I do believe in that idea that we all have this dharma, something that we're here for.
Yeah, it's about finding your dharma.
Yeah.
If you want to get technical on it, you know, esoterically technical. Yeah, finding your dharma. Well, that's fantastic, Nick. Thank you so much.
But
I think
to stop.
I know, this is what I love about these conversations, is that, you know, we could... but that's probably a good time to stop, and thank you so much.
A pleasure. You know, put my email address underneath. You know, I love to hear from people, and you know, generally, I'm very happy to answer specific questions.
Oh, really? Okay. So if people want to email you,
if Guy wants
to say, "Hang on a minute, I need to know a bit more," you know, he can email you.
Yeah, no, I'd love to do that because, you know, I love conversation. I love that connection, and it often gets me thinking. Either I've written about it and thought about it already, or if it's something I haven't, then it's great. You know. It's a great grist for my mill. So please get in touch. And, you know, I'm always happy if somebody's in a kind of leadership position or wants to step into more of their own leadership or anything like that. Drop me a line and maybe we can even have a conversation.
Exactly. Because I have to say, I found your course in Inspired Leadership that I did a couple of years back really, really helpful. I think it's fantastic material.
Thank you.
So,
well, thank you for the opportunity.
A pleasure.